This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.
Hello everyone, welcome to the History of Persia. I'm Trevor Cully, and this is episode 167, King Achaeus. Last time, we had a short, impromptu, Meet the Neighbors episode to cover Egypt in the reign of Ptolemy IV Philopator. I discussed the purge of the royal family and the aristocracy at the outset of his reign, some of his foreign and domestic policy choices, and ultimately how Ptolemy IV's reign ended with a native Egyptian revolt seizing control of the southern half of the country. The declaration of the first Egyptian pharaoh since the time of Artaxerxes III, and a Nubian invasion in the south. When we last covered the Seleucid narrative, Antiochus III soared to new heights in the Fourth Syrian War, very nearly conquering all Ptolemaic territory in Asia, only to be turned back in a catastrophic defeat at the Battle of Raphia, suffering terrible and demoralizing losses. Antiochus returned to the capital at Antioch to lick his wounds, and signed a peace treaty with Ptolemy IV in 217 BCE. Their borders returned to more or less what they had been before the war, but Ptolemy did agree to withdraw his support and recognition for Achaeus, the Seleucid royal cousin who had declared himself king in Anatolia. That left Antiochus free to rebuild his army, rally, and march north to reclaim territory that had been lost since his uncle Antiochus Hyrax attempted to rebel over 20 years before. However, Achaeus declared himself king while Antiochus III was busy fighting the rebel satrap Molon of Media in 220. He had several years of uninterrupted control in Anatolia, and a large part of the reason that Antiochus attempted an invasion of Syria before going after Achaeus was that the rebel king was preoccupied with events unfolding in and around Anatolia at the time. So before addressing the Seleucid reconquest, I want to address what Achaeus has been doing in the meantime. We left Achaeus himself in episode 162, when he was still Antiochus's leading general. Achaeus launched a campaign against Attalus I of Pergamon, who had successfully conquered most of Anatolia from Hyrax. Achaeus successfully pushed Pergamene forces all the way back to their antebellum borders in northwestern Anatolia, only making a play for the crown after achieving that victory. Initially, Achaeus went south, planning to seize control of the Syrian Seleucids and become the Seleucid king, but a mutiny among his own troops forced him to turn back and focus his efforts on independence in Anatolia instead. The first of the big issues Achaeus faced in Anatolia was simply the consolidation of power. To do that, he was eager to help the city of Penelesis in Pamphylia, southern Anatolia. Evidently, Penelesis was at least willing to back Achaeus, but their neighbors in the city of Selgae were not. The Selgians besieged Penelesis. Achaeus sent a general called Garsuaris to break the siege with a surprisingly large army, 6,500 troops from Achaeus' main force, and a further 12,000 from their allies in the regions of Pisidia and Pamphylia. Despite having a larger army than some battles with the other great powers ever saw, Garsuaris was caught in a trap when he arrived at Penelesis and made camp. The Selgian army turned around and besieged the camp instead. Fortunately for Garsuaris and the Achaid army, if we can call them that, they left a gap just large enough for the cavalry to escape. Thinking that these horsemen were fleeing from the siege, the Selgians ignored them, until the cavalry turned around and attacked the siege lines. They were soon joined by the soldiers from inside Penelesis itself, joining Garsuaris and the Achaid troops in defeating the Selgians and driving them back to their own city. At some point in all of this, Achaeus married Laodike, a princess from the kingdom of Pontus who had been raised in Selgae as a royal foster child, and the Selgians hoped to use that to their advantage. When Garsuaris besieged Selgae, they asked him to call for Achaeus to come in person and negotiate, on the assumption that he would show some favoritism to his wife's adopted hometown. Instead, when Achaeus arrived, he brought the rest of his army and besieged Selgae while Garsuaris assaulted the town's main citadel. The Selgians attempted to send out their troops, only to be vastly outnumbered and easily defeated, forced to negotiate surrender and submit to Achaeus as their new king. The next main event came as a byproduct of a war with some convoluted origins, since we haven't really been following the development of more minor Greek powers in the Hellenistic era. As we've seen when I mentioned the Antigonids, much of Greece was more or less as it has always been, a collection of city-states that divided themselves into a series of shifting geographic alliances that we call leagues. Other cities fell under the direct control of the major kingdoms, usually the Antigonids on the European mainland. The islands of the Aegean shifted back and forth between Antigonid and Ptolemaic influence. The Greeks in Anatolia shifted between Ptolemaic, Seleucid, and more recently, Pergamene dominance. However, a few individual city-states still remained powerful in their own right. We've seen examples of this in the Hellenistic era too, such as the role of Heraclea Pontica as an independent city-state among the petty kingdoms of the East. At sea, the island city of Rhodes had carved out a role for itself as a powerful maritime state. Not on the same scale as the major kingdoms, but powerful enough to maintain independence. Meanwhile, Byzantium held an unusually isolated position for a city that was technically right in the middle of several feuding powers. Thanks to the Byzantines' position on a narrow peninsula at the southern Bosporus Strait, they were able to easily defend their city itself from attacks by land and sea. However, the formation of a Gallic kingdom in Thrace and the ever-present threat of Thracian raids was highly disruptive to the Byzantine economy. Either the Byzantines could watch their own farmland burn in raids every summer and buy imported grain, or they could pay off the various Gallic, Thracian, and occasional Scythian raiders with ruinous bribes. They generally went with the latter option, but either way would have to make up the financial disparity somewhere. So Byzantium began heavily taxing all trade passing through the Bosporus. Larger states with wealthier merchants could eat that increased cost, but smaller city-states wanted to put a stop to it. So they implored Rhodes to use its naval power and break the Byzantine blockade. And soon enough, Rhodes went to war with Byzantium. The Rhodians promptly went to King Prusias of Bithynia, who had recently been distracted by a war with Heraclea Pontica that left his leg crippled after a failed siege. But he did hate the Byzantines, since he controlled the other side of the Bosporus. It was Bithynia, probably more than any other single power, that suffered losses from Byzantine trade taxes. So Prusias joined the Rhodian cause. Byzantium rushed to get its own allies. Historically, that would have been Heraclea, but they were still recovering from Prusias' last war. So instead, the Byzantines tried to get Attalus and Pergamon on their side. Attalus was also still recovering from his recent defeats. So the Byzantines tried their luck and finally convinced Achaeus to support them by starting his own war against Bithynia. Achaeus did support the Byzantines financially, but given that he too was recouping his strength after a war, no action came immediately. And Rhodes saw this as an opportunity to break the alliance. Achaeus' father, Andromachus, had been a prisoner of war in Egypt since the end of the Third Syrian War, and Ptolemy III had been offering Achaeus his father's release if he would rebel for years at this point. The thing is, Achaeus rebelled without actually making that deal, and when Ptolemy IV became king, his advisors Sosibius and Agathocles wanted to keep Andromachus in their custody as a way to pressure or threaten Achaeus should the need arise. So, Rhodian ambassadors went to Alexandria to demand Andromachus's release into their custody. And the Ptolemies were always eager to keep Rhodes and all of its naval influence on their side. So they gave Andromachus to the ambassadors, who offered Achaeus, his own father, in exchange for withdrawing support from Byzantium. Now Achaeus, he didn't care about Byzantium. It was just a plausibly good political move in the moment, so he took the deal and dashed the Byzantines' best chance for direct military aid. The Byzantines also tried to get Zapoites, Prusias's exiled nephew back into Bithynia to launch a coup, but the exiled prince died en route from Macedon. Rhodes proceeded to hire Thracian mercenaries, probably the same ones who raided Byzantium regularly anyway, to besiege Byzantium from the European side, effectively cutting the city off. Ironically, given how all of this started, the Gallic king Caveros intervened at that point to try and negotiate an end to the hostilities between Bithynia and Byzantium because the war was disrupting both any trade to the Gallo-Thracian kingdom Caveros ruled and whatever bribes the Byzantines normally paid him to not raid their farms. That brought Rhodes to the negotiating table, essentially trying to avoid this war growing into a all-out conflict between all of the minor powers, and the Byzantines agreed to stop taxing trade that wasn't actually stopping in their territory, on the condition that the Bithynians returned Byzantine territory they had captured on their side of the Bosporus. One of the reasons that Achaeus hesitated to engage the Bithynians directly during this brief alliance with Byzantium was the looming threat of Attalus and Pergamon. Even as Achaeus was taking hold of Pamphylia after defeating the Selgians and beginning his joint venture with the Byzantines, Attalus hired Gallic mercenaries from Europe and marched into Aeolus, retaking several cities that Achaeus had conquered in their last war. Most of the cities in this region, and the general that Achaeus left in charge, simply surrendered without another battle. Then there was a lunar eclipse, and the Gallic mercenaries, who were already dissatisfied with their pay and the lack of cities to sack in this war, took it as a bad omen. They refused to march any further. Not wanting to spark a conflict that would lead to his own mercenaries raiding recently acquired territory, or dissuade other mercenaries from working with him in the future, Attalus agreed to pause the war. The Gauls who wanted to go back to Europe were paid off and sent home, while anyone who wanted to settle in Attalus's new territory were given land on the southern side of the Hellespont as Attalus's new subjects that could be recalled to the army if and when an actual war started. It's not all that clear if that plan worked or not from Polybius's account. It sounds like these Gallic settlers near the Hellespont immediately started raiding the surrounding towns instead of settling as colonists. However, given that Attalus didn't do anything about it, we might want to interpret the conflict that happened here as the locals being unhappy with their new neighbors. Or, more likely, the local aristocracy being upset that Attalus redistributed their lands to the Gauls. In either case, the Greeks living around the Hellespont called on Prusias for aid, and the Bithynian army crossed into Attalus's territory to force the Gauls to either lay down their arms or flee back to Europe. Attalus, apparently, did not intervene in this invasion, so he may just have let Prusias do his own dirty work. All of these chaotic events in Anatolia happened in or around 217 BCE, the same time as the Battle of Raphia. And once Antiochus III had reassembled his army in 216, he began marching north to deal with Achaeus as a rebel. However, he was still recovering from the losses suffered in Palestine the previous year, and more importantly, did not want to perpetuate the cycle of conquest and loss that had plagued Seleucid Anatolia almost since the foundation of the empire. To that end, Antiochus sent messengers to Attalus in Pergamon and offered a deal. If Attalus joined Antiochus now, the Seleucids would recognize Pergamon as an independent kingdom with the borders it held before Antiochus Hyrax's rebellion. Attalus accepted, and together, Pergamon and the Seleucid Empire went to war with Attalus. And this war would have been covered in Book 7 of Polybius's Histories if we had it. Instead, we just have fragmentary excerpts from that section of the text, and we have nothing to describe the joint campaigns of Attalus and Antiochus from 216 to 214 BCE. We can probably assume that there were a series of battles and skirmishes in western Anatolia as this alliance fought against Achaeus's forces, but the next actual detail in the historical record is the conclusion of the war. Achaeus was driven all the way back to Sardis, where he was besieged by Antiochus. I get the impression from Polybius's account that Achaeus's former benefactors in Egypt had not anticipated Antiochus's swift turnaround after Raphia, or his alliance with Attalus, which, to be fair, seemed implausible at the time. So Sibius, Egypt's leading noble, arranged a plan to help Achaeus escape from Sardis and flee to one of the Ptolemaic-aligned cities in Anatolia. From there, an Egyptian army could arrive to help him renew the war with Antiochus. So Sibius got in touch with Bolis, a Cretan mercenary serving inside of Sardis, and arranged a plan to get Achaeus out of the city. Unfortunately for the rebel king, Bolis wasn't as trustworthy as Sosibius thought. Apparently, this mercenary knew that one of his own countrymen was commanding mercenaries on the other side, and smuggled a message out explaining the plan. When Achaeus thought he was making his escape, Bolis seized him and turned him over to Antiochus. The Seleucid army promptly entered Sardis and demanded the rest of the Achaeid forces surrender. That might have worked, but Antiochus's advisors wanted a swift public punishment for their rebellious former comrade. And I'll just quote from John D. Granger's book, The Seleucid Empire of Antiochus III, because it's been a long time since an academic text made me laugh. Achaeus was treated by Antiochus in much the same way as Molon had been treated, with the difference that Molon was punished after his death, while Achaeus was still alive. Briefly, Antiochus and his advisors went for maximum posthumous humiliation. Achaeus was publicly decapitated, then someone skinned a donkey, sewed Achaeus's corpse inside the donkey's skin, I'm guessing with the ass's head still attached to create some sort of horrifying anthropomorphic donkey Frankenstein corpse, which was then crucified outside the citadel of Sardis. Shockingly, Achaeus' wife and her supporters, still inside, didn't see a compelling reason to surrender, and they were so well supplied that the siege of the citadel lasted for almost an entire extra year after Achaeus' execution, until Laodike's commander finally forced the remaining troops to surrender. This brings me to an abbreviated tour of Seleucid Anatolia, at least as things stood under Antiochus III. We have mostly covered the cultural shifts in this region during the Seleucid period before, because most of them happened early on in the reign of Antiochus I, Soter. The interior, and to a large degree the Black Sea coast, was not wildly different from how the region functioned under the Achaemenids. The local Phrygians were largely agricultural people, though a large swath of them in central Anatolia now shared the land with the Galatians, who had been settled there by Antiochus Soter. The major road routes to and from Syria had seen a boom of urbanization under the Diadochoi, especially the early Seleucids, but that was nothing compared to the western coast. The explosion of new kingdoms trying to establish military outposts, trade colonies, and places to settle their veterans and immigrants from Greece and Macedon led to a new wave of urbanization and a number of new cities or expanded old cities, named after various Hellenistic royals. Mostly that was the early Seleucids, but a few were named for Ptolemaic notables that had popped up in areas governed by Egypt at different points in time. Today, I mostly want to try and explain the political geography of Anatolia, because it was a messy hodgepodge of competing kingdoms, semi-independent city-states, and geographic labels that the Greeks have been using this entire time, but I largely ignored when we were dealing with the Achaemenids. Understandably, a map would be helpful here, but I simply could not find one for this moment in time. We're sort of between major developments for the region, and nobody really bothers to make them. But Antiochus III's Anatolia was roughly the same as Antiochus II's back in 240. Anatolia was split between the Diadochoi kingdoms and their descendants in the south and west, and the various independent entities of the north and east. In addition to Byzantium and Heraclea Pontica, the Greek cities of Sinope and Trapezus were still largely independent along the northern coast, bordering on Pontus and Armenia, respectively. Cappadocia was still quietly an independent kingdom between Seleucid-controlled territory in the Taurus Mountains and Pontus on the northern coast. Bithynia controlled the Asian side of the Bosporus and the southeastern shore of the Sea of Marmara, stretching inland along the Sangarius River until it reached Galatia. Nominally a Seleucid vassal at its foundation, lack of Seleucid ability to actually enforce their will on the Galatians, and general consensus by their neighbors, left Galatia effectively independent and split between three major tribes, which had settled there after being defeated by Antiochus Soter. Between Bithynia, Galatia, and Pontus, the rugged highlands of Paphlagonia were now a political no-man's land, left to the local tribes and not really claimed by any of the surrounding petty kings. The Seleucids dominated the interior, broadly split into three regions. Mysia in the north, which covered most of what used to be Hellespontine Phrygia under the Achaemenids. Phrygia in the center, bordering Bithynia and Galatia. And Lycaonia, the region immediately south of Galatia and west of Cappadocia. The southern coast of modern Turkey was split between Ptolemaic and Seleucid control. The Ptolemies held much of Cilicia, especially the coastal highlands of the west, but the Seleucids controlled parts of the eastern Cilician plain surrounding the city of Tarsus. Pamphylia, right in the middle of the southern Anatolian coast, was now firmly Seleucid after being reconquered successively by both Antiochus and Achaeus, but Lycia, just to the west, had been solidly Ptolemaic territory for decades. Ptolemaic success in Lycia was helped in no small part by the Pisidians directly to their north. Nominally, Pisidia was Seleucid territory, but many of the local towns and cities had been in a state of on and off revolt against imperial authority of any kind since the time of Darius II. Following the coast north from western Lycia, we actually run into another separate state power. While the Seleucids controlled most of inland Caria as a military buffer against Ptolemaic territory, the southern Carian coastline and most of the riverways in that area were actually governed directly by the island of Rhodes as a territory they called the Paria. Historically, Rhodes had routinely subjugated a few cities on the coast nearest to their island. But at some point in the chaotic upheavals of the 3rd century BCE, the Seleucids had ceded or lost a large swath of territory to Rhodes for unclear reasons. As seen with the conquest of Sardis, Antiochus retook the province of Lydia in 214, but only the ancient Lydian heartland. Unlike Cyrus the Great, Antiochus's power did not extend to the Greek cities of the Carian Pentapolis around Halicarnassus, or the Ionian Greeks from Ephesus in the north to the Rhodian Paria in the south, all of which were still under Ptolemaic control during the Third Syrian War and remained there at our current point. From there, the coast was actually Seleucid, though several of the coastal islands remained independent states, aligned with either the Seleucids or the Ptolemies, until you reached Pergamon. It's not all that clear what territory Attalus I got out of his deal with Antiochus III. Mostly, Attalus now seems to rule the Aeolian Greek cities on the coast north of Pergamon and the Caucasus River basin surrounding the capital. Finally, that takes us to the northwestern corner of Anatolia, also formerly part of Achaemenid Hellespontine Phrygia. This was the region the Greeks called Troas, or the Troad, named after the city of Ilion, known in their mythology as Troy, of Trojan War fame. In the Hellenistic period, Ilion was still an important and functioning city, but after Gallic mercenaries revolted against Attalus I, the cities of the Troad were sacked. Ilion was besieged, and even after the Bithynian intervention, it doesn't seem like any of the local kingdoms had real control of the region until Antiochus sent troops in just to claim it after defeating Achaeus. As you can surely see, the situation in Anatolia was a chaotic one, primed for future conflict. But when Antiochus retook most of the region, he was only a few years removed from his defeat at Raphia, technically still in a truce with Ptolemy IV, and not eager to restart the war with Egypt. Instead, he focused on re-establishing himself in Anatolia. It had been decades at this point since the Seleucid king based in Antioch had actually ruled this region, and that itself spoke volumes. With all of the independent city-states and minor kingdoms, there was something in the air. When Achaeus tried to march on Antioch, his troops refused. But they were more than happy to have him as a local ruler. Clearly, there was a sense in Seleucid Anatolia that they were neglected by the king and didn't have anybody in power who promoted their interests. And it's easy to see how that sentiment developed. Every few years, it seems, somebody else carved out a bit of territories. Or the Galatians settled there by the Seleucids raided local farms. There had technically been a few satraps or centrally appointed governors scattered around the region at different times, but they rarely seem to have had centralized regional authority like the Lydian satraps under Persian rule. So Antiochus addressed that problem. After retaking Sardis, he may or may not have installed a satrap of Lydia specifically, but more importantly, he appointed Zeuxis, who had quickly grown to be one of the new king's favorite advisors after the war with Molon. Zeuxis was governor of all Seleucid territory north of the Taurus Mountains. Zeuxis was loyal to Antiochus and reliable, but a newcomer to Anatolia. He wasn't likely to attempt another secession movement. Antiochus took this a step further by introducing some new elements into the general Anatolian populace, adding some newcomers who were not as attached to the tradition of independent city-states or local affairs by recruiting some 2,000 Jewish families from Babylonia to resettle in Lydia and Phrygia. Granger notes that this sort of colonization effort was unusual for Antiochus III, who does not seem to have used similar tactics elsewhere. Personally, I wonder if it might have been a consequence of one or two other developments in then-recent history. The Book of 3rd Maccabees suggests that there was some tension between Ptolemy IV and his own Jewish subjects, and Antiochus may have hoped that the Jewish settlers in Anatolia could serve as an additional buffer against Ptolemaic influence. Alternatively, Babylonia had seen on and off riots and had just recently submitted to Molon's revolt with relatively little resistance. So it is entirely possible that these particular families were being sent to Anatolia to get them out of a region where they had been involved in unrest. Though if that were the case, it's unusual that it would just be the Jews and not other Mesopotamians. Or perhaps it was, and there's just a certain poetic irony about the Jewish population being deported from Babylon. Finally, Antiochus III took a note from Ptolemy IV and instituted a centralized royal cult in Anatolia, promoting the worship and temples of deified members of the Seleucid dynasty. Although not nearly as many members of his family had claimed godhood as the Egyptian royalty, the more successful kings had all been deified to one degree or another. Seleucus Nicator, Antiochus Soter, and most obviously, Antiochus Theos, whose epithet was literally the god, all had cults of one sort or another. So Antiochus III bundled these all together. This created an avenue for local nobility to donate to the dynastic cult's temples as a way to gain both royal and local favor, because those temples would do things to help the local community. Antiochus further centralized this religious leadership by promoting one of his counselors, called Nicanor, to the rank of high priest for all of the temples and shrines north of the Taurus, regardless of what god or pantheon they worshipped. It was an intentional process of building unifying elements into Anatolian society under Seleucid leadership. Sooner or later, though, Antiochus would have to depart from Anatolia himself and hope that Zeuxis was up to the task of keeping the region under control. He chose sooner, in the end, and the king, along with most of the army, began marching east in 212 BCE. They did not return to Antioch. By now, Antiochus had cultivated a strong and loyal council of advisors to govern in his absence, and had proven himself to be capable of leading in war, even if Raphia was a red mark on his record. There were other would-be kings claiming parts of his ancestors' empire as their own in the east, and Antiochus was determined to re-establish control of his entire empire. But that is a story for next time. Until then,
if you want more information about this podcast, you can go to hopfulmedia.com. That's where you'll find things like my bibliography, episode imagery, and additional resources. If you want to hear more of my voice, you can listen to America Secret Wars, where I tell my friends and guests the story of forgotten and overlooked conflicts in American history. And if you want to support my projects, you can go to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merch, or subscribe to get access to ad-free listening and bonus content. If you don't want to spend money on me, that's absolutely fine. The best ways to support a project like this are to share on social media or leave reviews on your podcast app of choice. So review on Apple, rate on Spotify, and you can find me on Blue Sky at History of Persia and on Instagram at History of Persia Podcast. Until next time, thank you all so much for listening to The History of Persia.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.